Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's September 20th, 52 degrees, and a bit of rain here in Old Town Park City, just a few sprinkles, actually. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Barker. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, a little bit of moisture creeping up from the south and west this morning. About a 20% chance of continued showers and storms into the afternoon. Not going to be a washout of a day by any means. Still dealing with above normal temperatures under southwest flow, about 77 for the high this afternoon in Park City. Overnight lows near 50 into Wednesday. Better chance of showers and storms on Wednesday afternoon and evening. Bit more widespread as we have an area of low pressure moving through the Beehive State. That'll bring continued showers and storms overnight into Thursday morning, with moisture clearing out throughout the afternoon. Highs will be near 64 on Thursday, 65 on Friday. Northwest flow will keep temperatures again in those mid-60s overnight, lows near 40. By the weekend, high pressure builds back in. So best chances of moisture again a little bit today, better chance Wednesday, lingering Thursday morning, but then dry weather settles in Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So gorgeous weekend is expected in Park City with warmer temperatures. Should be in the low 70s again by Sunday and about mid-70s on Monday, a high of 74 with more sunshine. Leslie.
Okay, Nate, thank you. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Utah legislator for District 54, Mike Kohler. We'll be talking about taxes and some interim legislative business. Park City Planning Director Gretchen Milliken will be in with a number of updates from different projects. And finally, the Executive Director of Recycle Utah, Carolyn Moore, will be by with her monthly update. Taking a look at some local news now, the speed limit on Park City roads could be changing, and don't expect to be driving any faster in town, with pleas from residents living in Prospector and Thanes to slow down the traffic in their neighborhoods. The Park City Council last week directed staff to look at lowering speed limits across the city to 15 miles per hour while allowing some wiggle room for exceptions for what are called collector and arterial roads like Meadows Drive. No action was taken, and Park City engineer John Robertson will come back to the council at a later date with his recommendations. With the passage of House Bill 235 this year, cities and counties are now allowed to establish their own speed limits on city streets without having to complete a traffic study. One Comstock Drive resident who noted that his mailbox has already been taken out twice this year supports a 15-mile-per-hour speed limit. He said there are a lot of speeders on his street who don't care about his mailbox or his kids, but maybe they will care about speeding tickets.
There's kids in Prospector. That's why a lot of us are here today. And we don't want you to have to make that phone call, or chief to make that phone call to a family to say your child's been injured, your child's been killed because of speeders. And that's the whole goal here, is to get the speed reduced, because that one phone call will change everybody's lives here.
Park City Council member Jeremy Rubel was the one who suggested lowering the speed limit citywide.
Like, why not just do it? Like, why not just say 15 miles an hour is the lowest common denominator and make all of the roads under our control 15 miles an hour? Because it doesn't include 224 or 248 anyway. Like, this isn't that big of a city. I mean, what's it going to take people an extra 10 seconds to get where they're going? You know, and if they break the law then good. Maybe we'll give them a reckless driving ticket instead of like a minor speeding ticket if they're going 35 down to 15. I don't know. But you see where I'm going? Like, why can't we just do that?
According to Robertson, except for State Routes 248 and 224, all city roads are already posted as 25 miles per hour, except for a few exceptions where the speed limit is 20 or even 15 miles per hour. Park City Police Chief Wade Carpenter said most people pulled over for speeding in neighborhoods are those who live there, followed by their friends and the service workers that are headed to a client's home. If they're not happy with the change, Carpenter warned, the council will hear from them.
I think you're going to be answering to your own constituents, honestly, on this. So that's a question, a policy question that you'll have to evaluate and say, you know, what level of enforcement do we want? Are we willing to stand behind that level of enforcement when we take the heat for it?
Rubel says that's the council's job, to make decisions for the betterment of the community and to take the flak that comes with doing so.
Personally, I'd say I don't care. I'd tell them, then get a ticket. I mean, and if you do it too many times, something else will happen.
Noting the police chief's request for consistency, Councilmember Ryan Dickey asked about a faster speed limit for the longer, wider Meadows Drive that he uses to get home. Robertson says that's where the rubber hits the road.
Meadows Drive's a really long, long local road, and someone can get extremely frustrated going 15 miles per hour on this long road to get one location. So that's where the speed could increase. We might get a lot of pushback at those kinds of roads where they're like, I got to get out of town and get to my job. So that's just things that we have to take into consideration. So it could be one disadvantage, just lowering everything to 15.
What Robertson and Carpenter said they don't want to see is the council putting something into place and then having to change it after a few months. Well, after nearly a year since the first announcement of a new temple to be built in the Heber Valley, its location is now official and construction will begin soon. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more on that.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints announced Monday the three-story Heber Valley Temple will break ground on October 8th. It'll be built east of downtown Heber City at 1400 East Center Street. LDS Church President Russell Nelson first revealed the plan to build a temple in the Heber Valley at the semi-annual General Conference in Salt Lake City last October. That day, he announced 13 new temples to be built worldwide, including four in the U.S. It'll be built on an 18-acre lot near the Red Ledges development and across the street from the Center Street LDS Church Stakes Center. In the months leading up to Monday's announcement, Heber Valley Church staff and government officials said they hadn't heard specifics. Wasatch County Planning Director Doug Smith said he expected the details to remain secret because the announcement could impact local property values. Also on Monday, the church announced on its website the location and groundbreaking date of another temple in Rexburg, Idaho. Since Nelson took over as president, he's announced 100 new temples. In total, there are 282 in operation under construction or renovation or planned around the world. Most recently, in late August, construction began on a new temple in Ephraim, Utah. The new temple location there is less than 10 miles from the Manti Temple, one of the first that the church built in the late 1800s. The church released an artist's rendering of the new temple near Heber City with its announcement Tuesday. Visit the web version of this report on kpcw.org to view. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
Well, Hurricane Fiona struck Puerto Rico's southwest coast on Sunday, knocking out power and causing catastrophic flooding. A Park City native who calls the island home happened to make it out just before Fiona made landfall. KPCW's Kimberly Flores has this report.
Jenny Hart grew up in Park City, but left Utah 6 months ago to move to Puerto Rico with her fiancé. The two had plans to return to Utah last week for a friend's wedding, but as the storm approached, it became clear that one of them should stay behind with their dog and shelter in place.
It kept shifting more south of the island as it was approaching, and so we were pretty confident that San Juan wasn't going to get directly hit.
The weather reports predicted correctly. Hurricane Fiona hit Puerto Rico's southwest coast. Hart and her fiancé live on the opposite side of the island in San Juan. Since arriving in the U.S., Hart has spoken with her fiancé daily. They consider themselves fortunate that cell service is working in their area. Her fiancé hasn't left their home and says he can't see much out of the window. Hart says he has enough food and water because they planned ahead. While they escaped the worst of the storm's damage, many in their area are without power, and some are even without water.
We're lucky enough that we do live in a building that has full generator power backup and a water cistern. And so I know that the buildings in our area, the water cisterns are starting to dry out. And I guess that they've been having issues replenishing them. But we are fortunate enough that we do still have power and water at our building.
Fiona made landfall just 2 days before the anniversary of Hurricane Maria. That storm struck Puerto Rico on September 20th, 2017, destroying the island's power grid and causing more than 3,000 deaths. 5 years later, many island residents are still struggling to rebuild. Thousands of homes reportedly only have blue tarps as roofs. Hart says many residents are dealing with post-traumatic stress in the wake of Maria and worry about what Fiona's devastation could mean for the island's already weak infrastructure.
There's still rolling blackouts just without the storm because the electrical grid hasn't been fully updated and things like that. And so with the power being out right now, it's just how long will it take to get it back on board?
While the storm continues to pound the island with heavy rain, Hart's return flight to Puerto Rico remains on schedule for Monday night. She hopes to reunite with her fiancé and pup as soon as possible. Kimberly Flores, KPCW News.
Joining me now on the phone, I have Utah State Representative Mike Kohler. He represents those living within the Park City limits as well as Wasatch County and District 54. Good morning, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, so are you running for House District 59? How is that working?
Well, the new district numbers in the redistricting system puts us now to 59. 54 was the old one.
Okay, but that's...
So yes, we are 59.
Okay, so that's what you're running for after, and that's what you would be, that's what the district is as of January 1?
Yes, as of this new election, so I assume January 1 is the date.
Okay.
Not sure, but...
So how will the boundaries of the district change?
It didn't change a whole lot. I lost a little bit north of 80 over in Silver Creek, but most of it stayed about the same. We grew a lot, but so did a lot of others. So that part went to Kira, and I think everything else stayed almost the same.
All right. Well, after hearing loads of complaints and accusations of even doing something illegal, you and others in the state legislature apparently are now working on bills that would change our tax law in Utah. Some people at last week's town hall, sponsored by the Summit County Republican Party, said that they're looking at some 40 to 70% increases in their tax bill this year. That seems a lot. Have they just been getting a good deal till now?
Not necessarily. I think it's kind of a perfect storm of two problems. One is we have had in the last 2 years, at least, really heavy escalation in values of homes. So instead of going up a couple of percent every year, it's gone. Some of them doubled. My property per se went up when I got assessed this last year, doubled in value. So your percentage that you pay goes up. Now, the second part of this is we've had some, as your values go up and as the county assessor goes throughout the county and assesses properties, if they don't get everybody, and it's impossible probably to get everybody, although they're supposed to be doing more than they do, even if they use computer programs to raise some of it. But if the law says you have to do 20% a year, so let's assume that they're on task for that. Both Summit and Wasatch County did better than that. But that means that those that did get reassessed now pay more, and the ones that didn't get reassessed, meaning the value of their homes was postponed for a later date, actually paid less. So one of the misnomers is that it gives the counties and the districts that get the tax revenue a big windfall, and it actually doesn't. It just is a factor of your value and how much you pay versus everybody else. So if yours went up a long way, somebody else's went down. It isn't a fair system this year. In most cases, 1% or 2% increase in a house value wouldn't have made a big difference.
Yeah, so was yours personally one of those that then was reassessed on that every five-year plan?
I haven't really paid attention to when it was last done, but it was at least 5 years. So, yeah, I was probably one that had been left off, so mine would have been lower in other years, but certainly they caught up this year. Now, that said, some of them have been reassessed every year. If you're in a high sale area, you get picked up a little bit quicker, and I know people in Wasatch County and Summit County have had their properties assessed every year, so they're always in the higher echelons of value, meaning they're going to pay higher taxes. And certainly I've had some that have in fact, one at the meeting the other day had a commercial property that had gone from 10 to roughly 30,000, which is a whale of a hit.
Yeah, okay, so that's what I'm seeing personally, because mine just went up a few years ago and then again substantially again this year, even though I'm not part of that five-year review. It's just a high sale area, I guess. All right, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I guess what changes are you thinking about proposing?
There's two or three things that we're looking at. One is to protect older citizens, 65 and older, usually on fixed income from these major increases. They in general, have a lot less of an ability to absorb it. So I think we're going to see some efforts to try and protect the value, or at least block make sure their values can't go up extremely high in 1 year. So it'd have to be a slower climb to make sure they don't get hit like this. The other thing I see coming is when we have high growth, value growth areas like we have now, where some properties actually double, we got to make sure that they use computer programs, they being the assessors, use computer programs to bring everybody up a little bit. Because again, if they wait till their assessed values are put in the quarter, in the five-year cycle, some of these could be 5 years before they get around there. And again, they're paying much, much less. I mean, Wasatch County and Summit County were almost mirror images, where we had 25% of the properties or more went way down in not value, but went down on their tax value because their assessment didn't change. Those of us that went up then absorbed the increase. There's a way to do that with factoring, that's what they call it, but where a computer program could better average out properties to raise everybody a little bit. Because they're obviously raised, it's just a matter of how accurate they can be without going out and seeing them.
All right, so when you talk about, you know, trying to limit the amount of tax for those on a fixed income, I mean, are you going as drastic as what California did and actually freezing taxes like Prop 13 did? Or are you just, it would be based on Social Security inflationary payments?
You know, there are several different things, ways to look at this. I think Prop 13 basically created a reverse mortgage. So is your property, let's say your taxes were $5 and you couldn't pay them, it just created a mortgage so that when your heirs, if I was the older person living there, once I don't need the house anymore and my heirs have to, then they have to come back and pay it all. I don't see the state doing that. I think what we're going to have, and my preference would be, is if you're 65 and older, live in your house and nothing drastically changes, you haven't made it bigger or remodeled to put an apartment, or, you know, nothing much has changed, that your increase in value would be limited to a percent or so every year, even if the total value of everybody else's could have increased more than that.
Yeah. So apparently some constitutional changes would be required to do this, which requires a vote of the people?
They will, because right now the Constitution says it has to be market value and everybody has to be treated the same. So, yes, there's going to be I'm sure there's going to be a constitutional amendment proposed to allow variations like this. Don't know what form it's going to take. I know there's a couple of them working on bills like this, but I haven't seen all the language yet.
Okay. So how did you sway the folks at last week's meeting then? I mean, they were claiming that county elected officials should be held accountable, even talk about some criminal investigations. Do they have a case?
They did, and I can't say that I agree they have a case, but there's a couple of things. I mean, the assessors have a job to do. They, in both cases, Wasatch and Summit County, and Washington County is the other really big increasing value county. The assessors just couldn't get around and to everybody and get everybody on the same page. So they did it piecemeal. Actually, Wasatch County did 60%, where 20% is the requirement. So we did have a pretty good increase, but it just then makes those that didn't get increased that much, the differential that much larger. So I think I can't say there was criminal. I don't think they were negligent. I just think they didn't have enough time to get around it. That's what I think the state's got to do now with the tax commission, because that tax commission controls all these local assessment the rules for the assessors. And we'll be working with them to say, all right, if you get to 20% or 30, 40, 50%, whatever it is, and they are at value based on an assessment that's fairly accurate, and the whole area is going up, that we can use computer programs to raise everybody else, you know, a certain percentage. It may not go the whole amount, where we've seen 50%, it might be 20%, but it was certainly made a big difference in who pays the taxes here. And those, the 25% of the counties that went down, or the county residents went down, probably would have gone down less or gone up a little bit to help the rest of us.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of making it all fair and also give them time now. We could hit a deflationary cycle here where our values go back down, and you got the same problem in reverse. So it's a strange time we're dealing with.
Right. And I know that Summit County has seen an onslaught of appeals. Wasatch County likely as well. Anything that
for sure.
What it would take to provide some resources to respond to those appeals?
Well, there's the Board of Equalization is set up to accept those appeals. I don't know that we've overwhelmed them yet. I know that it's probably going to be a record amount of appeals coming in. So we'll see what it is. But the county and the state tax commission, who supports the Board of Equalization, will put in whatever resources they have to do. And if somebody's not successful and they think they've been wrong, then they can appeal that to the state. So I think this is a process where some people are going to push this to the top. Haven't heard anything about lawsuits. Haven't heard anything about, I've heard things from people that said they'd like to, but I haven't heard if anybody's going to. So there's a lot of things that could come along to gum up the works, but as long as the BOE works, they'll put resources in it to make sure they cover it. Now, I would say this, if you're appealing, your chances of success based on statistics are not that good. And you can appeal on value, and you can appeal on equity, and equity is the one that people are hitting, because if I have a neighbor that's paying twice as much as me and I've got a house that's very similar in value, that's not fair, and that's what a lot of the appeals are going to be.
Okay, just a couple minutes here before I need to let you go. What's your take on the cease and desist letters that were sent out by Representatives Kara Birkeland and Carrie Ann Lisenby to abortion providers and abortion funding organization on official letterhead?
Yeah, I wasn't a signatory to them, and actually didn't even hear about them until they were out. I think it was a little preemptive, but I haven't talked to them, and I'll withhold my judgment until I talk to them. But the way I understood it and the way it seems rational is that once the stay was put in place, there's really not much that's going to change until the court's finished. And I thought probably a little bit presumptive to say that they could affect it that way. But again, they may have a very good case, and I haven't talked to them personally, Carrie Ann Ork. Or Representative Birkeland, to see what they were thinking.
Yeah, well, at least one law professor says that a judicial order that legally prohibits people from bringing an action or threatening to bring an action. So the rule of law is that the trigger law is not in effect, and it just seems like this could be an abuse of power by them because it feels so threatening.
I wouldn't disagree with that, but again, I'll withhold judgment until I talk to them, but yeah, I wasn't part of it, and I think it was a little presumptive to think that they can make a statement like that. I feel bad that it went down the way it did, but I've got to talk to them and see what they were thinking. I feel bad the way it went, but I agree with what you just said. I think once the stay was in place, everything had to be left alone until the court's done.
All right. Finally, just wanted any other items of interest to your constituents that have been done on an interim basis?
No, there's a lot of mostly water issues with the Great Salt Lake, and we've actually had a pretty good water year considering how it started. But I think this next session is going to be quite interesting when it comes to water and the Great Salt Lake and what we can do to save it, protect it, get more water to it. I think that's going to take on a big portion of our time over there. And then obviously the MIDA project that's happening over in Jordanelle is starting to take shape. And so there's quite a few things coming on that's going to make the session pretty interesting, I think.
Okay. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Talk to you later.
That's State Representative Mike Kohler. We're in the studio now with an update from the Park City Planning Department. I have Planning Director Gretchen Milliken. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with Poland Elementary, Park City High School. Still nothing happening there. What's the latest in terms of getting those projects going and saving all of us taxpayers a little bit of money?
Yes. We are working with the school system, the school district, to get those applications complete and moving forward. They have taken sort of a self-proclaimed pause to get everything in order, and they are also applying for a state permit at the same time. But they will be applying for two conditional use permits for McPolin and for the high school. The schools do require a conditional use permit, and they will be applying for a variance because the height on the high school exceeds the zone.
All right. So what was the confusion here? I mean, just new administrators just didn't know the process, or?
Yeah, I think it's a fine line there between state and local municipal code and what they're required to do, and I think there was just some miscommunication, misunderstandings.
Okay, so how early can those get on to the Planning Commission agenda?
We're working with them. We're trying to make sure that this gets on the agenda in the fall. We do have a very full agenda with the Planning Commission, but I think we're going to be able to squeeze it in at some point.
Yeah, and what happens with that height variance? I mean, is that just something?
That would go in front of the Board of Adjustments, and that's for them to decide.
And what if the Board of Adjustments says no? Then what?
There are other avenues in order to get the height. They could do a master plan development in which it would go in front of the Planning Commission for them to determine whether or not the height is acceptable. They are not asking for additional height to what the high school already is, but it does exceed the zone height requirements.
This would really skew the construction timeline.
Potentially, yes. I think we're all trying to work with them to make it move forward. To have it.
Okay. I guess just the lesson learned. I mean, because there are more construction projects that are going to happen. Well, I guess not here. Within the city, yeah? These are just the two?
Yeah, I mean, I think the lesson learned is reach out to us as soon as possible. If you know this is coming, you know, even if it's you don't have all your ducks in a row and you're not ready to submit an application, it really is helpful if you reach out to the city firsthand.
Okay. What's the update on the Hidden Meadows? They're called hotel houses. There was a hearing last week. What's the issue here?
Yeah, I mean, these are two single-family homes within the neighborhood that were legally allowed to do nightly rentals. The neighborhood has then, or the HOA has then gone back and changed the land management code, so nightly rentals are no longer allowed in this neighborhood. However, these two homes, because they were issued prior to them taking those steps, are legal non-conforming units, and so they do get rented out. They have been somewhat of a problem. They are nightly rentals, and there's much more comings and goings, and they're large homes, so they accommodate, you know, large parties of people as well. We continue to work with the community on enforcement and management of these properties to make sure that they're not a nuisance to the neighborhood.
I was going to say, if they in fact become a continue to be a nuisance, can you then take away that grandfathering?
I think we can take away their licensing for nightly rentals. Again, that's more of the code enforcement part of things. But I do believe there's things we can do if it really got out of hand.
Okay, so the status is that they can continue to do that.
Yes, they are licensed to do nightly rentals.
Okay, let's see. We heard the word moratorium again at last week's retreat. What's your take on that?
Interesting question. Yeah, we did hear it. The council mentioned a possible moratorium, and in this instance, it was more for the Bonanza Park area. We introduced at the council retreat doing a Bonanza Park Snow Creek small area plan, and I think there was some discussion about a possible moratorium while we kind of initiate that plan. At this point, we're still waiting for the mayor and the council for more direction on that and whether or not we would go in that avenue. Personally, a moratorium in this instance, it might be helpful in doing the planning initiative, not having additional building permits or planning permits coming into the department. However, a moratorium is, just to be clear, it is only for 6 months. And it just puts applications on pause. It doesn't, you know, stop them from coming in. And any applications that are currently have been submitted, it does not put a stop on those. Those would continue to be processed.
So I maybe talk a little bit about the land code, management code amendment process. I mean, do you have a plan to prioritize what needs to be done?
Yeah, we do have a plan, and that's based on sort of council direction, planning commission direction, and also what's in our general plan. Currently, we brought this in front of the planning commission at the last meeting, and it was unanimous that we continue to focus on incentivizing affordable housing development, encouraging sustainability through net zero development incentives, as well as improving the review criteria for pedestrian, bicyclist, and transit initiatives. So that was sort of the priorities coming out of the meeting that we had with the Planning Commission.
Okay, so what's the timeline on this?
Well, we've got a number of land management code amendments that are already in the process that are going to be coming in front of council this fall. Fractional ownership is returning in October. We also have water-wise and landscaping LMC amendments that will be coming in front of council. And then we will be working with the Planning Commission on the other land management code amendments to support those priorities that I just mentioned.
Okay. Well, let's talk about then the fraction of ownership. What are the changes that are being made there?
So it's not so much changes, but it's updating our land management code, because fractional ownership is a new, you know, model. We haven't had it before. So what we're we're defining it in the land management code, and then we are recommending that fractional ownership be restricted to the same zones in which we have timeshares. Sorry about that. The same area where we allow timeshares. So it's not that they would not be allowed in the community, but just being allowed in the areas in which we already have timeshares.
In the resort areas.
Yeah, okay. Close to the resort where we're seeing a lot of second homes. We're trying to help protect our primary resident neighborhoods and not have a lot of fractional ownerships in those areas.
All right, so Prospector, is that clear of a fractional ownership?
Yeah, that would not allow fractional ownership.
Okay, what about Lower Deer Valley, where there are a lot of second homes?
There's different zones in Lower Deer Valley, mm-hmm. So it's hard to, I don't have a map in front of me to give you exact, but we will, we do have a page on our website, and there is a map on there, so people can go on to the website page and see exactly where we are recommending fractional ownership be allowed.
Okay, and then another land management amendment, code amendment you'd mentioned was the Waterwise Landscaping and Conservation Study. What's happening here?
Well, that is to encourage more water-wise native plants, less water use, of course. We're actually going to be doing a survey. It's not out yet, but it will be out soon on engageparkcity.com. So people can weigh in and give us ideas and thoughts, and we're really just trying to incentivize better use when it comes to water. As we know, it's a very valuable resource in this part of the country, and we want to be progressive and doing our part.
Okay. Is this where, like, that cash for grass happens?
That's one incentive, yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. And then let's talk a little bit about the long-term planning implementation strategy, the Arts and Council, our Arts and Culture Feasibility Study, a Bonanza Park and Snow Creek Neighborhood Plan, as well as the general plan was discussed by the council at the retreat September 14th. So what's the plan to follow through on those?
Right. So we basically presented an action plan or an implementation strategy for these different planning initiatives, which would mean more or less immediately starting with the feasibility study for the Art and Cultural District. There was a feasibility study done in 2017. Now we are, you know, a number of years later, post-COVID, a lot of things have changed. So we want to update or redo that feasibility study in that area specifically. And at the same time, we are launching a Bonanza Park Snow Creek small area plan. Given the sort of development that's coming into that neighborhood, that it's already been identified as an area that could handle, you know, additional density. We want to really get a plan out there. This has been coming from council for some time. And so we're really excited to be launching a small area plan in this neighborhood.
So would this impact then the DoubleTree proposal?
No, those proposals have already been submitted. And again, if there were a moratorium, the DoubleTree and the Homestake would not be affected by a moratorium. And the plan is really looking at it more holistically, so it's not going after individual or projects. And it would take those into consideration, of course, in the plan. And providing recommendation and plan implementation strategies moving forward, but it wouldn't impact those.
Okay, and then when we talk about the Snow Creek, are we talking about the shopping center itself?
Mm-hmm. So in the general plan, there's a neighborhood identified. It's more or less referred to as Bonanza Park, but it does go across Kearns and include the Snow Creek commercial area. And, you know, while this boundary is identified in the general plan, when we do a small area plan, we're looking at connectivity between the different neighborhoods. So we would be taking into consideration, you know, going over into Prospect or Park Meadows or Thanes or the Resort Center, those connections and associations with those neighborhoods would be important as well.
All right. Because we had heard years ago about, I mean, there's certainly the opportunity to kind of redo what we've got at the Snow Creek Shopping Center, right? Keep the retail and then build housing on top. But that would require, like, demolition, no? Or is it structurally sound enough to build on top as is.
Yeah, I don't know how well those buildings are built or whether, I mean, it's definitely a possibility. And I think, again, that's probably an area that could handle a little bit more density. And having, of course, residential close to the shops and the amenities really supports a more walkable community and the car optional idea that we've been pushing.
Homestake. That we've got, what, 100 and or 240? What is the number? 247? I can't remember.
I would have to look it up myself. Yeah. Okay. But I think you're in the ballpark, yes.
So where do things stand with this? Sounds like it will be back before Planning Commission?
Yes, it's coming back before Planning Commission on September 28th, and that will be a public hearing.
So we're that far along on it?
Yes. Yeah, we're moving that forward.
So it could be approved with a conditional use permit and then be done and developers could start?
It's they are applying for an affordable master plan development is what they are doing. And under the affordable master plan development, they are allowed, if they meet certain criteria, for additional height, for changes in the setbacks, and for parking reduction. They are not asking for any parking reduction. They are asking for additional height with stepbacks. And I believe that this setback, I'd have to look on that if they're meeting those as well. But they're within the affordable master plan development criteria.
Okay, so any neighbors there on the Claim Jumper and other Homestake condos, then September 28th is their chance to...
Yep.
Okay. You've got one more Planning Commission vacancy to fill?
Yes.
You did interviews.
Yes. So the council did interviews at the last council meeting on Thursday, and we expect that the mayor will be appointing a new commissioner on October 6th.
Okay. And then with three new commissioners named, I mean, what kind of training and education do they get?
Yeah, right, so they're required to do 4 hours of training a year. One of those is under the Title 10, Chapter 9A of the Municipal Land Development and Management Act. So that's one kind of 1 hour. And then the other 3 hours are more flexible. They can dive into appeals and variances, impact fees, conditional use permits, a whole bunch of things. They're also, most of the commissioners exceed those 3 hours of additional training. They will go to land use conferences or do online training as well. But we are planning to, good question, we're planning to do a training session with the Planning Commission because we do have three commissioners coming on. And I think just looking at the schedule for the fall, we'll probably have to do a special session on that.
All right. The PEG applicant. Any word about getting back on the agenda?
I haven't heard from PEG on that. So no, at this point, it's still paused.
Okay. Anything else, Gretchen?
No, I just would encourage everybody when that survey comes out on water-wise landscaping to please take the survey. We'd love to hear from the community.
Okay. Gretchen Milliken, Park City Planning Director, thanks for your time. In the studio now with an update from Recycle Utah, it's Executive Director Carolyn Moore. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So first off, it's time to clean out your medicine cabinets and garages. The semi-annual Summit County Household Hazardous Waste Collection happening Saturday. Tell
yes.
us how it works.
Yes, it's a busy weekend in our town here. Coming up on Saturday at the Canyons parking lot from 9 until 1. Us in partnership with the Park City Sunrise Rotary Club volunteers, we collect paints, varnishes, solvents, chemicals, motor oil, antifreeze, pharmaceuticals, electronics, batteries. Pretty much if you've got something that you're like, this is probably not very safe, I don't really know what to do with it, you should probably bring us to bring it to this event and we're going to figure it out.
Yeah, so what about like TVs?
Yep, that counts. Bring TVs. Ideally, you can lift the TV by yourself, just kind of back safety for the volunteers there. If the TV is really huge, you can ring by the recycle center that day and we can use our forklift to get it out for you.
Okay. Mattresses?
Yep, that's the only thing we charge for at this event. We do collect donations that help cover the cost, but mattresses are $20 per item. That's per box spring, per foamy mattress, per normal box spring mattress. Some things we do not take are refrigerators, tires, or household recycling. Believe it or not, we've had people show up with their cardboard and aluminum cans at this event and just bring those to Recycle Center like normal.
Okay. Interesting. You guys are going to start collecting ski wax, huh, with the PFAS?
Yeah, we've been working with Michelle DeHaan and Mike Lures on this. We are going to take PFAS at our hazardous waste day, and then we're exploring launching a program where we collect it at the Recycle Center. Hopefully more to come on that with Michelle and Mike, who are really the experts. Hopefully a wintertime program to collect more of it to get it out of town. And I'm not the expert. I'll kind of let them speak to the expert on it, but PFAS stands for polyfluoral substances. So this would be a wax that says poly or fluorinated on them, like if you look at the ingredients. And if you're not sure, again, just bring it. This is an event. You know, if you're not sure what to do, just bring it. The chemicals in these waxes can get in our waters and our community, and we're working to kind of just get this out of our community, do a sweep, collect it at Hazmat Day, and hopefully collect it at Recycle Utah starting in October. So more to come. I'm thinking Michelle, Mike, and I will come on the air to talk about that program once we launch it, and they can get into all the details. But for now, if you have ski wax, you're not sure what to do, bring it to Hazmat Day. If you can't make it to Hazmat Day, probably going to be an option starting October.
Okay. Listener wants to know if she can bring her old car battery.
Yeah, bring that to Hazmat Day. We also take those at the Recycle Center anytime that we're open. So,
okay. Is there a charge for that?
Nope.
All right. And again, this is for Summit County residents only.
Yep. Summit County residents only. No businesses. I've been doing this event. This is probably my 12th one or so by this point. I can tell if you're a business. Don't try to trick me. If you live in Wasatch County, you can bring it to the Wasatch Transfer Station. That's located by the airport. They have a separate program. Again, in Utah, these type of events are handled different by each county, and this is how Summit County does it, and we do to collect zip codes on the way in.
Okay. Let's see. Also happening is Dumpster Days, and that's just Friday and Saturday. No more Thursdays, huh?
Right. The hauling costs with fuel prices and diesel prices have kind of gone up, so we've kind of just to save some costs in partnership with the city and county, we just do this on Fridays and Saturdays. So it really is clean out anything you got weekend in Park City. If you're around town, it's time to clean out. Dumpster Days, we have one large dumpster for garbage and one large dumpster for yard waste. Yard waste can be leaves, branches, clippings like that. Ideally, no weeds. Weeds should be tied up in a bag, and those will go to the landfill. The green waste is actually compost, like composted or chipped into wood, so it does have an end purpose, trying to keep the weeds out of there. And then the large bin for garbage, this can be something like a broken toilet, maybe some drywall from a project you did, maybe you replaced your deck. Again, anything that doesn't really fit in your curbside trash bin is a great option for this event. And if you can't make it this weekend, again, we do have it at the end of October, on October 28th and 29th.
Okay. Again, unlike the hazardous household collection day, there are things you do not take here. The mattresses.
Oh, yeah. Mattresses, tires, refrigerators, and hazardous waste will have to go to Hazmat Day. So really, mattresses at neither event, tires at neither event, refrigerators at neither event, but the Summit County Landfill at Three Mile Canyon does take those things, and they're open like 8 to 5 Monday through Saturday.
All right. How many dumpsters do you go through?
Depends. It depends on kind of the weather. Green waste tends to be a little bit more popular. Normally, green waste maybe 3 per day, which is, 6 or 9 for the weekend. And then trash, not as much. And that is a little bit bigger dumpster, so I'd say maybe 2 per day of that one.
Okay.
But it does depend on, like if there's been storms, we've had wind storms come through town, and then we see about double, that there's so many more branches are down. So I feel like we've had a pretty mellow fall so far, but nobody knows yet. So we'll see what we get in October.
All right. What's happening on October 2nd? Another community cleanup?
Right. One of our volunteers, Dave Nicholas, has been pretty a rock star, being out almost every weekend doing cleanups. It is Utah Climate Week. That's usually last week in September, the first week in October. And to have an event up here in Park City, we're going to do a community cleanup on Sunday from 9 until 11:30. You can meet at the dog park located out in Rhone Valley on 600 Gilmore Way if you want to join us.
Where are you going to be cleaning?
We'll kind of break out in groups from there. It always is pretty messy under the 40 underpass there. We'll head there. Families with kids will kind of probably keep them a little bit more safe in Rhone Valley. Other groups can go along 248, but we're going to kind of tackle that area. David ends up about every weekend out somewhere cleaning up, and he kind of knows where it needs to be hit, and he's kind of thinking that's a good time to hit that area there that weekend.
Okay, and then save the date for the Utah Recycle Utah's Harvest Fest.
Right. This is an event that was kind of going pretty strong before COVID, and then COVID, we kind of backed off a little bit. We're bringing it back. It's coming up October 8th, noon to 5 at Cattleman's Hall in Oakley. And we're at about 50 different vendors selling all kinds of arts and crafts, homemade goods. It's going to be outside. We've had a few questions with Cattleman's Hall. We're going to be outside. If it does rain, we'll have the vendors that have tents use tents, and the ones that don't, they can go inside Cattleman's Hall. But will happen rain or shine. We have a Comrades food truck and then some bluegrass music by Picking Out the Stingers. And then a free kids activity. If you have kids, you can bring them. Clever Octopus, their reuse store in Salt Lake. They're coming up to do a fun little kids craft with us. And this is the first year that we've had a grant from the Park City Chamber of Commerce. They did a sustainable tourism grant program late this summer. And we applied for it for this event. And so it will be a zero waste event. And we're giving out some reusable shopping bags, encouraging the vendors, and really spreading the word on shopping local and supporting your local artisans in that process.
Okay, and one of the things to look forward to are apple pies for sale?
Yes, that's a long time of this event. I think Inza and Sally Elliott started way back in the day. The Noon Rotary Club, we get together the night before the event and make a bunch of pies, and we do sell them, and that's a fundraiser for Recycita, so kind of a fun thing. And we try to get the apples from Summit County. There's a couple trees out in eastern Summit County that we've been collecting apples from. We go out about once a week and grab apples and make pies out of them.
Okay. And you mentioned you got about 50 vendors. Did you sell out? Because I know you had put the word out to, you're looking for folks.
Yeah, we're looking for about 60. So we're kind of considering ourselves good enough to go right now. I think in the past we've had the max, we probably had a 65 for this event. And again, the Cattleman's Hall is a little bit tighter venue than where we used to have it at Hydesar. So we're going to kind of cram everybody in and see how it goes.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, thanks for the update.
Okay. Thanks. Carolyn Wara, Executive Director of Recycle Utah. Well, the Park City Board of Education is meeting today and will review several policy changes, including some related to how employees report child abuse. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
The district's policy for reporting child abuse hasn't been revised since 2007. The changes the board could approve Tuesday include significant additions that look to strengthen and clarify what employees are legally required to do when they suspect abuse. Specifically, the reporting policy emphasizes that abuse should be reported, quote, immediately. It also includes provisions that say the district requires abuse prevention and awareness training. Additionally, it states that Utah law requires reporting for vulnerable adults over the age of 18. The Park City School District and the Summit County Attorney's Office settled misdemeanor charges against the district in June for failing to report suspected child abuse. The resolution essentially leaves the charges open for the next 2 years while the county attorney monitors the district's compliance with mandatory reporting laws. As part of that compliance, the school district agreed to supplement its annual employee training on suspected abuse reporting, to follow all reporting laws, and to cooperate with any investigations into suspected abuse or neglect. The district is also looking at altering its student search policy. The change would give administrators the ability to search students or their property if they have suspicion they are carrying electronic cigarettes. Superintendent Jill Gaudet and Chief Operating Officer Mike Tanner are both scheduled to give monthly updates. The board will also hear from MOCA, which is the consultant working with the district on its school construction projects. The district is in the process of expanding services at four of its campuses with funding from last year's passage of an $80 million school facilities bond. The Snyderville Basin Planning Commission granted the district a conditional use permit for its Jeremy Ranch Elementary upgrades in August after a stop work order was issued due to the lack of a conditional use permit. Construction work at Park City High School and McPullen Elementary, which fall under state and Park City municipal jurisdiction, are both currently halted due to not having the required paperwork. The meeting is scheduled to begin at 4 p.m. at district offices on Kearns Boulevard. It will be streamed on YouTube at the channel PCSD Communication. A link can be found at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.